The Sunstone Theological Society presents Religion, Man's Primal Temptation, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Sunstone. The paper, which we'll hear this afternoon, is titled Religion, Man's Primal Temptation. First, we will hear from Carlisle Hunziker. He's the director of the Institute of Constructive Living. He's a former instructor of the Salt Lake Institute of Religion. We will hear comments from Edwin G. Brown. He is the founder and clinical director of Highland Ridge Hospital. Mr. Hunziker.
We'll hear comments from Brown if he comes. He's not here yet, so we might have to hear comments from you folks. Can you hear all right? Speaking this way, you okay? Okay. In a shrewd phrase, Henry Miller speaks of the immorality of morality. Albert Schweitzer contends that the good conscience is the invention of the devil. Alfred North Whitehead suggests that the simple-minded use of the notions right or wrong is one of the chief obstacles in the development of ethical awareness. To these statements, I would add the observation that religion often stands as a deterrent to the development of spirituality. Let an anecdote shared by Joseph Fletcher serve as a means of underscoring the tone and intent of these statements. We may need all the light we can get. Is that better? Now I am in trouble. To the anecdote. A friend of Fletcher's arrived in St. Louis just as a presidential campaign was ending. And the cab driver, not being above the battle, volunteered his testimony. I and my father and grandfather, before me and their fathers, have always been straight-ticket Republicans. Ah, said Fletcher's friend, who is himself a Republican, I take it that means you will vote for Senator so-and-so. No, said the driver, there are times when a man has to push his principles aside and do the right thing. The same concern is effectively expressed by the charge, we're so full of what's right, we can't see what's good. The point which emerges from these assertions is disturbing. It is the eagerness of our search for God and the good which leads us astray. This is disturbing because we understand intuitively that the honoring of the human in human being is inextricably linked with the passionate quest for truth and for the good. The quest is essential, but our very commitment to it can be our undoing. We so often succumb to the tendency to twist and bend good to the service of evil. Why? Why is this? What is there within us which gives rise to this problem? Let us eavesdrop on a hypothetical conversation between a young woman and her LDS bishop. The young woman sought the interview with her bishop because she felt, to use the current expression, burned out. For some time now, she's been struggling with a vague uneasiness, as she describes it, the sense that she was not connecting with life. In her discussion with the bishop, she emphasizes how hard she has been trying, and she reaffirms her commitment and her testimony of the gospel and her desire to be righteous to serve, to do the bidding of the Lord. The problem is that with all of that, she feels unfulfilled, anxious, and confused. The bishop's response startles the young woman. The gist of his comments, something like the following: I perceive that your problem is that you are trying to do your duty. You are trying to be happy. You're trying to win the celestial kingdom. You're trying to feel safe and secure. You're trying to be obedient. You're trying to be righteous. You're working very hard at being humble. I believe we are eavesdropping on a wise bishop, and that in this counseling session, he is inviting the young woman to embark upon an essential but potentially dangerous journey toward enlightenment. We're only at page 2. This is Ed Brown. What are the insights the bishop wishes to share with the young woman? Obviously, he will work very hard not to be understood by her to be saying that duty, obedience, righteousness, humility, and so on are not matters of appropriate concern. Perhaps he will end up suggesting that the problem is with the vantage point from which she pursues such virtues. But that sounds a bit vague. We have more work to do if we're to second-guess the bishop or provide our own response to the all-too-common complaints of the young woman. I believe the portion of the bishop's comments we heard suggests that his concern is very much in keeping with that of many of the Old Testament prophets and Jesus as they railed against many of the religious practices of their day. We are familiar with the oft-quoted denunciation issued by Amos: I hate, I despise your feast days. I will not smell in your solemn assemblies. Though ye offer me burnt offerings and your meat offerings, I will not accept them. Neither will I regard the peace offerings of your fat beasts. Take thou away from me the noise of thy songs, and so on. The terminology and setting are different, but this sounds very much like the bishop saying to the young woman, I am troubled by your devotion to duty, by your desire to be righteous, by your efforts to be humble, and by your anxious striving to merit the celestial kingdom. Of course, the most familiar and most passionate denunciation of a particular style of religious observance is Christ's condemnation of the Pharisees, as recorded in the 23rd chapter of Matthew. What emerges as the fundamental problem here? What is it about the religious practices of their day which evoked the condemnation of Jesus in the prophets? And what troubles the bishop about the young woman's style of religious involvement? Perhaps a statement from one of George Bernard Shaw's plays will provide an updated version of these condemnations. In this palace of lies, a truth or two will not hurt you. Your friends are the dullest dogs I know. They are not beautiful. They're only decorated. They're not clean. They're only shaved and starched. They're not dignified. They're only fashionably dressed. They're not educated. They're only college passmen. They're not religious. They're only pew renters. They're not moral. They're only conventional. They're not virtuous. They're only cowardly. They're not even vicious. They're only frail. They're not loyal. They are servile. They are not dutiful, only sheepish. They are not public-spirited, only patriotic. Not courageous, only quarrelsome. Not determined, only obstinate. And he's just warming up. Not considerate, only polite. Not intelligent, only opinionated. Not imaginative, only superstitious. Not disciplined, only cowed. And not truthful at all. liars, every one of them, to the very backbone of their souls. Shaw is describing people who play to the gallery, people who are caught within the debilitating, stifling prison of self-concern. And I believe Jesus and the prophets were condemning the religious observances of people who suffered from the same problem. The passion, which is so evident in Jesus' condemnation, issues from an awareness of the human being's tendency to take the very key which could liberate him from his prison of narcissism and transform it into the heaviest bolt on the door. Why? What is the structural flaw, if you will, which manifests itself in this problem? The answer, I believe, simply put, is distorted images of God, and therefore of self. What is required is what someone has referred to as a psycho-spiritual tectonic shift, a major revamping of our fundamental assumptions concerning the nature of God and man. Traditional theologies, all arguments to the contrary notwithstanding, cast man in the role of an ontological cipher. The basic assumptions of these theologies portray him as being at the mercy of a God who enjoys a monopoly of power. This ever-watchful and all-powerful God tests man's obedience and worthiness with various configurations of reality. The world becomes a stage on which to perform, and the events of life are viewed as a series of deliberately designed obstacles and challenges orchestrated to produce a life experience something akin to struggling to get through a police or military training course. It is important to note that to the degree that you espouse these basic assumptions, you come to believe that everything happens for you. You are the center of attention. What matters is your performance. Let us set the stage for this psycho-spiritual tectonic shift by admitting, finally, that man's metaphysical impotence has been a basic assumption of almost all traditional cultures. This is why this assumption and its implications are rooted so deeply within our psyche. To live within such a theological, philosophical frame of reference is to inevitably fashion moralities and use religious involvement as a means of justifying ourselves before God, others, and self. In other words, the tendency toward narcissism is a manifestation of metaphysical distortions. In this regard, it is interesting to note the many references to blindness which are woven as a single thread of emphasis through Christ's denunciation of the Pharisees. The obsession with self, which characterized the mode of being manifested by Amos's people, the Pharisees, and the young woman who sought the help of her bishop, does not manifest an innate character flaw, but issues from ignorance. Let us now be more thorough in portraying the way of being which issues from a religion based on a thoroughly external control system. Within such a frame of reference, the whole world tends to be used as a huge echo chamber which feeds back to us the signals or experiences we need to construct our own moral personalities. All relationships, institutions, and events serve as instruments for our tendency toward predatory self-assertion. Stated another way, we perform not with or for, but by means of another person. Other persons become interesting only as instruments for our fulfillment or objects for our dedication. The presence of other people, particularly suffering people, grant me the opportunity to be devoted and loving. And that is where my focus is, on being devoted and loving. This is what Alan Watts had in mind when he stated that nothing is really more inhuman than human relations based on morals. That is, when a man gives bread in order to be charitable, he is as cold as a clam. He does not actually see the other person. I must be right, good, a real person, heroic, loving, self-effacing. I efface myself in order to assert myself. I give myself away in order to keep myself. The whole thing is a contradiction. We have always been haunted, and I'm still quoting Watts, we have always been haunted by the feeling that the sins of the saints are worse than the sins of the sinners, that in some mysterious way the one who is struggling for salvation is nearer to hell and the heart of evil than the unashamed harlot or thief. The would-be saint walks straight into the meshes of this web because he would become a saint. End of quote. Remember that the root of all of this is to be found within our perception of God. For the theist, images of God constitute some of the major planks in the ground floor of selfhood. And these same images constitute a kind of screen through which he views the world. While it is true that our awareness of God, if it is to be authentic, must have an experiential component, we must not lose sight of the fact that our experiences, even of God, are filtered through a conceptual screen, just as there is an imaginative or conceptual element built into one's very sense of self. This capacity to conceptualize is among our most precious possessions as human beings, but if we let it run wild, it can also be the source of our undoing. Historians and anthropologists have achieved a vantage point which impresses them with the way in which dehumanizing social institutions, superstitious beliefs, and religious sanctions are thoroughly intertwined and mutually reinforcing. That which provides the ground floor lighting for all of these systems, particularly in traditional cultures, is a view of the real power behind the scenes, that is, a view of God. This point underscores the importance of the discipline of theology. In the words of Gordon Kaufman, from the point of view of our further humanization, some images of God, including some with roots in the Bible and in certain strands of Christian tradition, are exceedingly dangerous, and worship of such gods will only further human depravity. It is not enough, then, to advocate devotion to God if human well-being and development is our concern. Devotion to some conceptions of God is dehumanizing, and it is little wonder that many great humanitarian reformers in past and present have found it necessary to disassociate themselves from traditional Christian beliefs and to take an agnostic or atheistic position. We must be prepared radically to criticize and reconstruct traditional ideas of God if God is to continue to serve as an appropriate object of devotion for our time, one who truly mediates salvation. I wish now to provide a brief sketch of the essential points as I see them to be found within what I'm calling the traditional religious perspective. The first and most basic point is that God is to be understood as controlling power. All things, allowing no exceptions, are possible to God. This implies that all that occurs in the world is ultimately in keeping with God's will. And here is the soil out of which grows the belief that nothing can or will be different, which leads to a passive-reactive lifestyle. The further implication is that God is really not out to accomplish anything. After all, if he enjoys a monopoly of power, the world is already his. His primary concern is to test our obedience and worthiness. And if that is his primary concern, then it is our primary concern. The second notion is that God originates and lays down the rules of the game and punishes offenders and rewards the obedient. Some of the corollaries of these notions are, first, the world becomes again a kind of stage on which to perform, or a kind of gymnasium in which to develop myself. Since God is in control, the real issue has to do with my performance, but not for the sake of a contribution I can make. How could I contribute to the contours of a reality which is fashioned by God? Another corollary of these notions concerning God is that to the degree that I take them seriously, I will develop an anxious turned inwardness. I will inevitably fall victim to the narcissism which was alluded to earlier. I will tragically spend my life attempting the impossible. I will spend my life trying to be good. And now we are at the root of the problem. For, with Viktor Frankl, we recognize and affirm that human fulfillment requires that the self become subject and not the object of existence. The traditional religious perspective makes human fulfillment in that regard impossible, and because that perspective locks its adherents within the prison of self-concern. I believe the young woman who sought the aid of her bishop was experiencing the stifling and debilitating nature of that prison. I believe the portion of the bishop's counsel which we overheard suggests that he understood her problem. "I perceive," he said, "that your problem is that you're trying to be good, dutiful, and humble, that you're trying to be obedient, you are trying to merit the celestial kingdom." My fantasy in playing out that hypothetical encounter between the young woman and the bishop is that he would not have counseled her to exercise more faith with the expectation that somehow things would work out, but that he would in fact have pointed out to her that her faith is not the problem. The problem has to do with the way she is objectifying her faith. In my mind's eye, I see the bishop endeavoring to lead the young woman to an awareness that she is caught within the traditional religious perspective, and that it is that perspective which creates the screaming need to justify herself, to prove her worth, to do the bidding of the ever-watchful, all-controlling I. It is that perspective which makes religion an enemy of spirituality. Recall that the woman complained of feeling burned out. To be self-consciously in pursuit of righteousness is like trying to imitate the high tides of the soul, or it is like trying to produce an effect without cause, and that indeed is tiring. It is the drumbeat of futile self-oriented striving which has sucked the life out of this young woman, and which can make of her a very likely candidate for either the role of continuing drudge or a member of the rank and file of those who have concluded that true life is to be found outside the pale of religious experience. I believe that such a conclusion is misguided, but I fear the ranks of those who see such a conclusion to be their best alternative will continue to swell unless we become more willing to engage in the difficult but rewarding task of fashioning an alternative to what I'm calling the traditional religious perspective. Furthermore, I am convinced that there is to be found within the distinctive features of LDS theological thought the seed ideas of that alternative perspective. But I agree with B.H. Roberts that we have hardly begun to plant. We need to get at it because we desperately need the life-giving nourishment of the harvest. I haven't the time to attempt even a rough sketch of what could replace the traditional perspective. I've tried to do that on other occasions, and so have many others more able than I. But think for a moment of the impact of bringing into view a God who has become fascinated with a magnificent possibility, the enhancement of the quality of existence. The world is not a stage, it is a cultivatable garden. By the dictates of reality, God's modus operandi is persuasion, and he requires our free and creative participation. It is participation rather than performance which he attempts to elicit from us. In this frame of reference, God is not the observer from behind the scenes, but rather the senior cultivator in the garden who beckons us to assist him. Rather than devoting ourselves to the self-defeating purpose of being righteous dutiful, good, or trying to go to heaven, God would have us participate in the redemption of the world. And then our righteousness ensues as a functional byproduct of our commitment. The world, said Abraham Heschel, is unredeemed and deficient, and God is in need of man to be a partner in completing, in aiding, in redeeming. I'm not forgetting that God is the source of all redemption, but again, in Heschel's words, man holds the keys that unlock the chains fettering the Redeemer. Here we begin to see a way out of the prison. We are catching just glimpses of an alternative theological frame of reference which our bishop would endeavor to share with a troubled young woman, a perspective which could evoke from her and from all of us a liberating self-transcendence. And it is that self-transcendence which is the very key. And so I close with a quote regarding it from, again, Viktor Frankl. I have come to understand the primordial anthropological fact that being human is being always directed and pointing to something or someone other than one's self. To have a meaning to fulfill, or another human being to encounter, a cause to serve, a person to love, only to the extent that someone is living out this self-transcendence of human existence, is he truly human, or does he become his true self? He becomes so not by concerning himself with his actualization, but by focusing outward. Consider the eye, an analogy I am fond of invoking. When, apart from looking in a mirror, does the eye see anything of itself? An eye with a cataract may see something like a cloud, which is its cataract. An eye with glaucoma may see its glaucoma as a rainbow halo around the lights. A healthy eye sees nothing of itself. It is self-transcendent. The troubled young woman suffers from spiritual glaucoma. The cure is to turn away from the traditional religious experience. Thank you.
I don't know what he said, but I hope I live up to it. My name is Ed Brown. I'm trying to cover two bases today. I have a company party going on up at the Spruces, and I got behind a very slow car coming down the canyon. I didn't have time to change, but I'm glad to be here and to share some thoughts and ideas with you. I'm especially excited about talking on this subject. Carlisle and I are friends from a long time back, and we don't get much time anymore to talk ideas, and so we'll use this as a forum and an opportunity for dialogue. I'd like to start this by sharing an experience that I had just yesterday with a very devout Latter-day Saint in a counseling session. This is a man about 42 years of age. I'm seeing him at the time when he is going blind, at the time when he has been separated from his wife for a period of a year and a half, and just learned last week that she is no longer wanting to reconcile with him, that she had only been separated from him and not divorced him sooner because she was afraid that if she left him that he would do something drastic to himself, such as try to take his own life. And this is a man who fulfilled a mission. This is a man who was a good Latter-day Saint from the time of his early childhood. We were talking a lot about his childhood and about the pain and the hurt that he's experienced through life prior to this current hurt. Because I think this is a man who leads his life, who enters a situation with great hurt and neediness. And indeed, it was this neediness and hurtfulness that sowed the seeds for the destruction of this marriage. And he's having a hard time understanding how God could do this to him.
This is the end of side one.
21 years of age, following his mission. His mother had a heart attack. They lived in a small central Utah town.
His mother had a heart attack while working at the family store. Father sent her home with one of the employees. He came an hour and a half later. He went home a little later with mom. It happened that this was on a Friday, on a Saturday. It was conference time. It was state conference time. He's an organist, and he was playing the organ for the evening sessions and was playing the organ for the choir and for the two sessions the following day on Sunday. His father came home. Mother was still sick. The doctor had not yet been summoned. They didn't know it was a heart attack at that point, but she was having all of the symptoms, as he described it, and as he later knew, came to find out. Father sent him when it was time. He found himself in the conflict. Father sent him to play the organ for the evening meetings and to leave him with Mother. He went, he got to the steps of the stake center, called it a tabernacle, and the people saw that he was obviously distressed. He was under a great deal of pressure, and they noticed, the two ushers, and they said, "What's happened?" He says, "My mother is homesick." And he said, these two men said, "You belong at home." The first, in my mind, indication of anything that is rational and human going on in the story so far. Go home, that's where you belong. Now, this is the same church that says family comes first, okay? He went home. And he called the doctor, and he got in touch with other family relatives, and he got things squared away. And he stayed up with his father, and at 3 a.m, his mother passed away. He said he could not allow himself to cry. He could not allow himself to begin to grieve or mourn. Why? Because he had duty the next day. He was up the next morning, got ready, went off to conference, played the organ in all the sessions, played the organ for the choir, and was praised from the pulpit by the president of the Quorum of the Twelve and another member of the Quorum of the Twelve, who were the visiting authorities. And he described to me the strange feeling he felt inside. He said, "I've always been chained," wasn't his word, but that's the image I got, "to duty. Duty comes first." But he also said, "I got rewarded so strongly for it." I said, "Well, what's wrong then? You got your reward, what's wrong?" He said, "I don't know." And I said, "I'll tell you what's wrong. You've always been there for everyone else. You've always put everyone else's needs first, including the needs of the church and the organization, and you have not learned how or been able to put your own needs there for yourself. Not from someone else, but from yourself. You did not and have not, and up to this time have not allowed yourself to grieve for your mother, for yourself, because you were doing your duty." I can understand those feelings. I've had them too, haven't you? Who here has not left a sick child or a sick wife, or have not left some kind of an ox in the mire at home to go to duty? When I first got married, I was married the first 2 years. We had the first 2.5 years of our marriage. We had two kids. We were in Topeka, Kansas. I was made a bishop. I was finishing a postmaster's internship at the Menninger Foundation. I had my brother-in-law living with us, because he was cutting up at home, and they got him out of there so that we could take care of him. My wife was pregnant with our second child. No, she had our second child by then. And I had to travel 70 miles one way to the stake center to take work crews over there to help build that chapel. And I was gone several nights a week, at least twice. I'd take two lunches, one for noon and one to eat in the car on the way over to Kansas City. And there were many a night that I said, "Oh, I don't want to be doing this," but I never told my wife. I didn't tell her till years later. And she said, "Oh, I wish you'd have told me that. I thought you preferred doing those things to being with me." Yes, we all have felt it. Let me go on with my story with the man. We grieved and we mourned, and I had him there with me go back through visualization to the scene of his mother's death, and he cried. But it's not the same. There is a time and a place for this, but there was no time and place for this in his life. And this man has carried that hungriness, this emptiness of not knowing who he is throughout his life. he has become a shame-based person. A person who, unless he does everything perfect, everything right, feels that he is less than. And what I see Carlisle talking about here in this paper is how our church and our institutions and our beliefs, personal and ecclesiastical, push us in the direction of being shame-braced. Unless I do everything perfect and everything right, it's not that I haven't done them well or bad. That's guilt. I do a job well or I don't do it well. I do it or I don't do it. I'm guilty about that. That's a good emotion that says either agree to do it or agree not to do it. If you agree to do it well. If you agree not to do it, then don't be passive and accept the job and then never do it. That's a corrector for ourselves and for our lives and for saying that we're inconsistent with our values and our beliefs. But shame says that if I don't do it right and if I don't do it well, then I am less than. I am inferior. And that's what this man feared. He has gone through his whole life feeling inferior unless he does everything. And that doesn't quite do it either, because he's never really been able to learn and discover what it is that he wants and feels, because he's always looking to the external world for the definitions of what he should be and what he should feel and what he should think and what he should talk. And we call that condition codependency. And churches, indeed, even the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, helps to create that. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how churches help to do that in just a moment. But going further with my counseling, my friend, my brother, terribly, terribly, terribly great pain. And he enters into a marriage with great neediness. He says, oh, the first 6 months were wonderful. He married a woman, his first marriage, her second, who had been divorced and had several children. And then he found himself in competition with other things in her life. And things that she did, he interpreted as against him. I said, like, what kinds of things? He had such neediness to be given to. Well, we were carpeting the house. Her house, by the way. We were living in it. And we had decided upon the colors we were going to have on the floor of the for the carpeting. And we had them all decided. And her brother came to visit from out of state. And she got out all the carpet samples and she laid them in front of him and says, which ones do you like? And he said, this red. And they had chosen a very neutral beige. I said, what color did you carpet with? Well, the neutral beige, the one we had decided on. But I felt betrayed by her. Betrayed? Doesn't track. It doesn't follow. She's sharing herself with someone else, is kind of what he's saying. I need her all just for me. Well, I'm holding up before you an individual who is a high priest, a member of the church in good standing, given great devoted service to the church, but has never allowed himself to give service to himself. Now, I think that that's inconsistent with the gospel, with gospel teachings. I hope to be able to show that to you later. With that kind of little vignette in mind, I want to turn to the text that Carlisle has shared with us and just dialogue with him as I dialogued as I read this. Okay? It is eagerness of our search for God and the goodness which leads us astray, he says. I say, it is the compulsivity, the drivenness of the repressed emotions from the pain and the hurt that is either induced and that is carried within us that oft times promotes us or gives us, pushes us to the good deeds. Let me talk just a little bit about shame. Shame is all of those labels and all of those titles that are given to us when we don't please others in authority. You're no good, you're evil. You're stupid. You're clumsy. You're a klutz. You're a dork. We get it from peers. We get it from parents. We get it from implied the sinner, the person who doesn't do what they're supposed to do in the church. And we believe it. And so we feel that we are less than another person. It's a very, very draining emotional experience. It's a very devastating experience. And the immediate reaction to this emotion is to separate ourselves. We flush, we blush, our eyes go down, and if we can physically run away, we do. And when a person tries to approach them again, more often than not, they are met with a verbal and oftentimes physical battle of pushing people away. I am unworthy. I am not good enough to be in your presence, to stand in your presence. Now, there are two ways in which people then carry this self-perception with how I am in the world. One is we believe those voices and we have a tremendous inferiority complex. And we cannot be reassured through the good works we do that we've done well enough or good enough. There's another way, and notice they are polar extremes, and it's the extremity of living that is the killer. The other extreme is that I become very self-righteous and I set myself up as the judge, and here are the Pharisees. And here are also the do-gooders, and I'm going to use the word do-gooders as those who are doing good for, I think, reasons other than maybe they're even aware of. I am well, you are not well. I am whole, you are not whole. I am good, you are bad. I know how to get my needs met, you don't know how to get your needs met. And in the process, we miss looking at the individual or the human being who is having this struggle and for whom the expression of these behaviors is an expression of the internal struggle. I don't know how better to meet my needs, perhaps. But I set myself up as the judge, as it were. Now, albeit a righteous judge, and I'm coming with mercy, and I'm coming with great tenderness and great empathy and great love to give my gift. But I'm not giving the gift of love. I'm giving the gift of... it's not really a gift. I am carrying out on you and with you the pain of my shame. In my judgment of your neediness, in my judgment of your condition, I am expressing my own shame. Now, where does this take us? It takes us again to our belief in God, but even before our belief in God, Carl, I'd like to suggest it goes one step further. We didn't have this talk before he wrote the paper, and it's a good thing we didn't, or I wouldn't have had a lot to say. I need to know me. Because Carlyle said it here, and I'm going to say it in a little more direct way. Just as we are created in the image of God, I believe we create God in our own image, in the image of where we are at any given state of development in our life. And if I do not get my needs met, I am going to view God as a withholding, authoritarian, punitive, vengeful God. If my needs have been met lovingly and kindly and appropriately and at the time, I will see him as a God of mercy and a God of love and a God of kindness. I think our whole purpose on this earth is not to judge others, not to judge ourselves, but to examine ourselves and getting to know ourselves. So what am I saying? I'm saying that we all grow up with hurts in our lives, just as the gentleman that I mentioned, the brother that I mentioned from my counseling yesterday. We all have those hurts where we've been told those names. We all have our shame. Interestingly enough, we get our hurts when we are expressing our emotions and our feelings and we are expressing our needs. We are told you shouldn't be hungry. We are told you shouldn't have pain. We are told you shouldn't hurt. We are told you shouldn't cry. All these things that are relating us to the world. We relate to the world through our emotions and our feelings. So I think we first need to come to understand and know ourselves. What are our needs? What I don't get enough of in my church, and I guess your church, I'm presuming the majority of us here are Latter-day Saints, is opportunities to look at myself without shame and guilt, to look at myself without being held up to the duties that I've done, to look at myself as a person struggling to understand myself and to meet my needs. And as I get to know those needs and as I get to understand myself, then may I go as a wholer or weller person, because it's an ongoing process, to serve my fellow man as Christ told us again and again that we would do. But now when I go with that service, what do? I share with that person what I have learned about me. And perhaps it might be of use to you. I go to my fellow beings with, I will be there for you. Oh, I love the story of Job at the beginning where his friends sat with him on the dung heap for 3 days and didn't utter a word as they shared with Job his grief and his pain and his sorrow and his hurt. And didn't utter a word, but they were there for him and with him. But then when they did start to speak, what did they do? They said, Job, you must have done something horrible or God wouldn't be punishing you this way. Getting right into the God that Carlyle was telling us about. You must have done something horrible. And Job said, no, I haven't. And in this, Job showed his great humility. But they persisted, and all the way through, they're trying to get Job to acknowledge something that they didn't have. They were imposing their shame on Job, and their shame was, we don't know God. And Job was telling us all through the book of Job, I know God because I know, and this is Job's humility, I know my relationship with God. I know how I have not sinned with God or with my fellow man. And you can't talk me out of that relationship. Job first knew himself, and then he knew God. I just recently became acquainted with the definition of humility as knowing my relationship with God, where I stand with God at any given time, because it's a dynamic, it's in the process all the time. I believe that we first, and the whole purpose then is to understand ourselves. So I go and I give my service to my fellow man, and what is that service? I give you what I have to give. I give you bread, I give you clothes, I give you whatever experience or understanding I have for this situation and how it's worked for me. I give you my presence so that you don't grieve and stand and sit alone. And that's what was the wonderful gift that those friends were giving at first. I will be your presence so you don't grieve alone, because it's when we grieve in the presence of other people at our losses and as our hurts, we find ourselves and we heal and we're able to grow. Oh, where do we find it when we go to church now and we say, how are things? Wonderful. I just left my kids half killed at home. I just left my drink, alcoholic husband or whatever, but everything is fine and wonderful. Don't ever let me show my grief or my sorrow or expect to grieve and sorrow with you, my brothers and sisters, in priesthood, in Sunday school, in Relief Society, in MIA or wherever. Go get more pain and grief and told how you need to go out and serve others and not care to and serve yourself. And so what else do I give them as I'm serving there? I go away not judging them for what their condition and what I've learned about them. But I go and I say, what have I learned about me in my service? You see, the giving and the sharing is just the beginning. Again, another mirror, another arena, a stage if you wish, but it's my own internal stage. Not the stage of the public, but my internal stage where I can really be honest, and my stage shared with God and my Savior. What did I learn about me? Did I learn how hard it was to give? Did I learn how hard it was to listen? Did I learn how afraid I am of anger? Did I learn how afraid I am of difference from another person? Did I learn how this person whom I judged before I know them as evil has more spirituality than I? Who can in their sins go and talk with God, and I feel the only time and way I can talk with God is when I am perfect and I never reach perfection, so I never really talk with God the way this person talks with God? That's the kind of service that I think Carlyle is alerting us to and that is challenging us to find. But at first it's in getting to know ourselves. And then looking to God, I think. But also asking and recognizing God as the all-powerful being. And I want to talk about the all-powerful being for a minute. As a source of strength for me to look at me. A source of strength for me to take my trials and tribulations. And a source of power to overcome and accomplish and do things that I cannot do on my own. I've never thought of God as the one who knew everything, and I know that I'm arguing with some of the general authorities on this, and particularly Bruce R. McConkie. I don't think he knows everything, and I don't think he has all the power, because I think there is power beyond all of us and any of us. But I do think that he understands it and knows it, I don't know how much better, certainly better than any other being or creature that I know of. And maybe he knows all about all the power that there is, and I would like to think that. No, I don't know that I even need to like to think that. So I don't see him as judging me by following the commandments. I think he says, it's kind of like what I just described. I want to share with you, Ed, what I know about life in mortality. I'd like you to know what to do to keep your body as healthy as possible. So I'm going to give you a word of wisdom. Now you have your free agency, you have your choice, you have to decide what you're going to do with that knowledge. But there will be consequences depending upon the use you make for it. Now, I'm working with alcoholics and drug addicts day in and day out, and I see what happens to people who don't follow that wisdom and that knowledge. It's not a moral issue of they're less than I am or I'm better than they are. Oh, I learn so much from them. Oh, I see so much love and caring. And I also see the depth of love. I happen to believe that the more we suffer, and I'm not going out looking for pain, I'm the one that doesn't like pain and I'm one that really loves life, but I do know that out of the depths of my sorrow come a greater capacity to understand and a greater capacity to love. And so I'm around some of the most loving, caring people in the world, day in and day out. But I sometimes share this with some of my real Orthodox church members. They say, what are you doing associating with people like that? I'm growing. I'm learning. Because I'm sharing what I have with them, they're sharing what they have with me. And that's the relationship I think of with God. I'll give you more knowledge and understanding as you are able to understand it. And as you apply it to your life, you can expect better and better things to happen for you. Well, I had this all written out systematically, but just felt like I wanted to talk to you about it rather than kind of read it or go into it in a more formal way. Let me talk just a little bit about how it is that this distraction comes to us. This is taken from the works of a psychoanalyst. She's a child therapist from the Freudian, neo-Freudian, and ego-psychology orientation. Her name is Alice Miller. She is Swiss-German. Her works are translated into English and have been for the last five, 6 years. She said that Nazi Germany really brought our society face to face with the fact that we've been living in an authoritarian world. This authoritarian world said that there is a single way to do it, there is a governing power in charge. Just the kind of God that Carlyle talks about in here, and the view of God, is that authoritarian world God. And she says because people bought in so much to that authoritarian belief, this is the way a lot of people put it, the most advanced culture, the most advanced scientifically, the most advanced nation socially, Germany, allowed itself to buy into the greatest inhumanity that ever appeared on the face of the earth. And it's facing us to look square into. Why do you think people are denying that it ever happened? It's more than just a historical event. The whole idea about authoritarianism is being challenged, and another model is being held up, and the other model is participation. Participation in life. Participation in being. And where do we, and how do we know about that participation? What happens to me when I live, and when I try ideas, and when I refuse to apply knowledge and truth? What happens to me, for good or for bad? Participatory democracy would put it in political terms. Free agency with a heavenly father who knows knowledge and truth and shares it with us liberally is the way I would see it in ecclesiastical terms. Now, what happens in this fight? A lot of us are reared in an authoritarian way. And we're seeing the vestiges of that, and it's coming out more and more as people are saying, I have a right not to be treated this way. How do you understand the child abuse that's going on? How do you understand the sexual abuse that's going on? How do you understand the violence that's going on? How do you understand the drug war that's going on? I'll tell you how I understand it. I think, again, it's this shift and this changeover that says people are participating, people are standing up and saying, I feel, I have a vision that I can be a part of life and not just be a cog in the wheel. And they stop and they look back with people like me and my friend in counseling, and they look and they see how they've been hurt and how those hurts carry with them and how those hurts affect how they then turn relate to other people. I cringe when I see how authoritarianly some of the teachers treat my kids. I'm under their stress. they haven't been nurtured in a way that makes it possible for them to nurture someone else. So they put their shame and their hurt on my kids and your kids in the name of the authority of teachers or policemen or whatever. But hallelujah, we're in the process of that change. Oh, this is a great time to live. It doesn't scare me, because it's a great time to live. We're finding out and discovering that I can make a difference by discovering and knowing me. Carlisle raises the question of making a contribution with God, being more than just that we were the rats that run through the maze. And God says, oh, these over here, they made it. Celestial kingdom. Those over here, they didn't make it. Put them wherever you want to put them. It's not that way at all as I see it in the gospel. He says, it's down here. The knowledge is here. Do with it as you will. And see what comes of you. See the transformation that takes place in you as you get in touch with truth and as you try that truth out on yourself and you let that truth work for you and on you. And I would like to submit, Carlisle, that there is a contribution to God. My contribution to God is not a great work, a shed over at the end of my life. My contribution with God is when I stand before the judgment bar and I said, I did this truth, that truth. I sure struggled with this one, but finally it came after. It may have taken an addiction to chocolate. It may have taken an addiction to alcohol. It may have taken an addiction to work. But I finally learned it. And here I am, and this is what I am, and this is my contribution to you and to the universe. This is my contribution to existence, because this is what I take with me now. Wherever I'm going, to continue to share through an ongoing eternity of progression. Let me just say one more thing, then I'll be quiet. Hope I've related this enough to Carlisle's speech, because it's what got me thinking about it. A good speech to me is one that gets you to think, and Carlisle's got me to thinking, obviously. He's tied into some things I've been thinking about before I got here as well, and some things that I experience every day. I'm grateful for a prophet, Ezra Taft Benson. Yeah, and I've heard all the scary things about what would happen to the church if Ezra Taft Benson became the prophet. Well, he'll get the mantle of prophet, and he'll be a changed man for all of those that fears and worries that some people had. I'm grateful for a prophet that's saying, read the Book of Mormon. Because it will tell you two things. It will tell you who are the antichrists, who are the enemies of Jesus Christ. And it will tell you how to live in today's times. I'm the gospel doctrine teacher in the 20th Ward, the Monument Park Stake. I've taught the Book of Mormon for about 6 or 7 years as it rotates through gospel doctrine teaching. And I've never, ever read it the same as I've read it this year. I'm reading it from the perspective that says, what is this saying about what I am experiencing? Where am I in relation to all of this? The gospel has become a very personal relationship between me and Jesus Christ, between me and God, and between the people that I interact with on a day-by-day basis. And I find myself becoming a more spiritual being. I'm also the ward mission leader in our ward. And I don't set quotas. I'm sorry, I don't. But I'm following, I think, the spirit that says, what is this person experiencing? And just let me close sharing one other human experience. There's a man in my ward who's a returned missionary, who's been excommunicated from the church and been out of the church for 12 years. He loves the gospel, hates the church as an organization. I got permission from my stake president to be able to have the full-time missionaries meet with this brother. I got acquainted with his grief and with his sorrow in my Sunday school class. Watched him carefully as he heard different things as we were talking about. And I went to him and asked if I could just meet with him and share his spirit and share his pain. I said, I need your experience. I need it. I felt I needed what he could give me. Not what I'm going to give you. I need to be there with you for me.
I see in the gospel. All of the knowledge and all of the skills necessary to help us become what we can be. I'm grateful for the doctrine of progression. I'm grateful for the doctrine of free agency. I'm grateful for the doctrine of the brotherhood and the sisterhood of mankind. And I'm grateful for a God that shares his knowledge. In the name of Jesus Christ.
This is the end of this cassette.